Welcome back, everybody, to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I am Jason Snellen. Across the internet from me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Jason. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. It's right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
This is our last 2017 TV Talk Machine.
It's kind of stunning.
Don't look for us next week. We won't be here.
We won't be here.
We will be sitting in a corner somewhere, probably wearing sunglasses and drinking wine, something like that.
Well, there'll definitely be wine drinking. I'll give you that much.
For sure.
Yeah.
I bought some today. It's important. At the BevMo.
It's
at the
crucial.
BevMo where I got the Agent X alcohol that one time. Same place. Same place. Shout out to Agent X. Well, I'll raise a glass for
to the
William Blake Heron and Agent X.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Well, we got a couple of great topics today. Before we get to them, we should cover some stuff that you posted at The Hollywood Reporter in the last week.
First
off, HBO launched a miniseries in the middle of the holiday season about the gunpowder plot in England. It's a historical, and you reviewed it. And it sounds like it's, let me see if I can boil this down. It sounds like, yeah, it's fine. And who's going to watch it? Because there's so much TV and there's so much to do going on in this, you know, this season anyway.
Yeah, that's a succinct.
I could feel you're like, why is this here? Why do you do this? Which is not to say that, you know, Kit Harington and Mark Gatiss and the rest of the people involved in Gunpowder, like, it's not to say it's not a good miniseries. It's just like, it just, see, you don't want to be ungrateful, right? You want to be like, oh, you got me more television. Great. Thanks. I didn't get you anything. But that's sort of what happened.
Yes, that is, I think that's, everybody does excellent work in this miniseries. You should probably watch it at some point. I do not know why it came out late in December. I'm not sure we need another Guy Fawkes story, but I'm happy that they turned Gunpowder into, a not so guy. Like, Guy Fawkes is I think it ran in England on that day, but over here, the emphasis is not on, and Fox is one of the characters, but Kit Harington's character is the main one. But again, yes, I watched it and I was like, okay, this is perfectly fine. What about the 46 shows I picked for 2017? Did anybody finish those? Maybe you'll finish those first. Start them.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I don't know.
But it's there. If whenever people want it, if you've got HBO, you've got a miniseries about the gunpowder plot and related subjects.
And related subjects, yes. I noticed, by the way, that this week and last week, I had to notice it because I was doing it. But it dawned on me that basically, if you're in the I'm sure if it's the same as music critics and film critics and stuff, but like particularly just for TV critics, there's all these things that we do, episodes and performances, and later we're going to be doing, we are doing a worst of list, which I did not know. You really cannot leave at the end. You can't take vacation at the end of the year. Like December, trying to get a vacation in anywhere in like Christmas time, forget it, because you're still going to be working on them. And that's like the THR way, right? Like if you actually took the week off, you would still be getting these emails saying, hey, we need that list because it's, we need like top 10 favorite TV episodes and top 10 favorite, performances. And then you literally cannot get away from it. And this is after compiling the, which we talked about last week, and I put a lot of effort into doing the 46, but whew, it never ends. You can't take a vacation.
No, it never ends. You gotta run away. And the list making, everybody, the world demands lists, Tim. That's
apparently
just it. The world demands lists. So you did two of them.
Mm-hmm.
With Dan Feinberg, you did, the favorite performances,
ten
favorite episodes. And the nice thing about you and Dan doing this right is that at least you only had to come up with five.
I only could come up with five. That's pretty good. And then you, and yes, that's true. Which one do you want to start with?
Let's talk about episodes. I'm always fascinated by this. I don't watch enough TV to you know, take a crack at this, but I definitely always have liked the idea of what episodes of shows were the tops, because oftentimes you end up with things that are different than just a general holistic best list. When you're like, no, this, you know, it's either the high point of the great show, or it's a show that's kind of like not as acclaimed, but did that one amazing hour. So I always love the best episodes list.
Yeah, and we found that, like, you know, doing that is difficult, and because there's so many, like, we could have, you know, and I was worried that it was going to be all like Game of Thrones or whatever. So we kind of just said, because, and again, how do you quantify it? And I think we did best last year. So this year we were just kind of like, how about we just say what were our personal favorites? Because then you could kind of like take a great episode, but it doesn't mean that you have to, like, it has to be Game of Thrones, or it has to be, right, you know, something that everybody's talking about. So
that, yeah, that's a good little editorial behind the scenes stuff, because I do this too, which is best and favorites. I know you may not even notice it happening, but right, it totally makes a difference when they say favorites, because it's like, it's just me. I'm just making a list of things that I like. I'm not saying that I've checked everything and it's all scientifically proven to be the best. I just like these five that I thought of, and here they are. So
yeah, and I think it allows you to sort of not get hung up on, excuse me, was that the best episode possible of like Mr. Robot. In fact, I picked an episode I think a lot of people would
say, I was surprised, yeah,
the weakest one, and but I quietly enjoyed it. So my picks were Fargo, The Law of Non-Contradiction, which of course there was a contradiction in it, but it was just the one-off, you know. I just loved that where Gloria is not in the snow and she flies to LA to do something. It's a self-contained episode. It really has nothing to do with the rest of the season, other than to you find out somebody's name and how they got it, and then you rule out a hunch that she had. But it was just, it revealed a lot about her in the process. Plus, there was some weird, super weird elements to it, and I really loved it.
And then you got a Leftovers episode in there. I was not surprised.
Yeah, that one, I think I would actually say it is probably the best Leftovers episode. I mean, that one's hard to argue. But, you know, it's the one, it's a Matt world. It's because I just love that they go on this, there's a nuclear disaster, which means they can't fly. They have to take a boat. They get on a party boat that's an orgy boat. And the orgy participants worship a lion. And they, once Matt was played by Christopher Eccleston, who also was, in my best performances for his work in The A Word. Once he gets on this party boat, he sees a man throw at the top of the boat where no one is, all the orgy people are down below, throws a guy off the top and basically kills him. And the person who throws him off the top, claims to be God. You know, this series delves into faith quite a bit. So there's a lot around, who is this person? Maybe he really is God. Maybe he can cure people, but he also just murdered somebody. And then it involves, a lot of things, but it ends up, no one believes that somebody threw somebody off the boat. And then there's a lot of stuff, existential stuff about God. And then the last scene, there's a group of lion protectors hiding among the orgy goers, and their whole goal was to free the lion that was held captive. And so they free the lion, and the lion races off the boat once it's docked and tracks down in the parking lot and eats God. And the episode ends with Matt saying, "That's the guy I was telling you about." It's tremendous. And it is like, that episode ended, and my jaw, I laughed so hard and my jaw was on the floor, because it was just beautifully constructed and it was absurd. And he's literally thinking, is this person actually God? And then,
the lion eats him. Yeah.
In the parking lot.
What a way to go.
And then Legion, not too much to tell you there. It was just one of those things where they got inside David's brain, and you got to see the world's angriest boy in the world, with the greatest, also the greatest book title ever,
yes.
The World's Angriest Boy in the World, who looks like Hitler. And then the Yellow-Eyed Devil, which looks like a gigantic Puffin, H.R. Puffin stuff character that's going to kill you. And you're in this brain, and it's nightmare and running around. And so that was a great episode. And some, and then
some surprise Jermaine Clement in that one too. That's what I remember, yes, about that one. It's like, yes, what is happening now? Jermaine Clement is here. Yeah,
it was such a trip. Mr. Robot, the one I picked, I know a lot of people don't like that episode. It's the one that gives the backstory. It's, I think it's the third episode. It gives the backstory of Tyrell Wellick, and it fills in some gaps of where he was at the end of season one and two.
I will say, for people out there who want to hear more about Mr. Robot, I did a podcast this week with a couple of friends of mine. It's on The Incomparable. Mm-hmm. I'll put a link in the show notes, the TV podcast, where we just basically talked about Mr. Robot season three, since it wrapped up, and people can go listen to that. And I raved about that episode because of not did just you? What it is, but what it says. Because think about this show and how it deliberately does things you don't expect. It's the resolution of the season one cliffhanger. In third episode of season three, which is amazing, it also resolves a bunch of things about the season two cliffhanger and paints a picture of everything that happened in between them. And so that's all amazing. And the fact that they waited until the third episode of the third season to do it, they didn't really come back with that. And it wasn't in episode two. They're like, okay, now three episodes in, well, let me tell you what's been happening for the last 2 years. And I think just the fact that it's done that way is kind of amazing. And then how it all hooks together, it retroactively puts Bobby Cannavale into previous parts of the show where we never saw him, but now we know that he was there. And obviously episode five, I think the one that's the single shot is the one that I think everybody's going to highlight as a great episode. But this was a fascinating, as we were watching it, we're like, oh my God, this is just all going to be about what Tyrell Wellick was doing. And it is, it's amazing.
yeah, it was. And I totally disagree that people think, he was, so why do we need to know that? You need to know that. I love that. I think you more eloquently put that together about about the structure that Sam Esmail put together for putting this in the third season. I just liked how it was cleverly filled a lot of gaps. And also you get to know a little bit, like Wellick was just, he was such a weird character. You couldn't put your finger on, is he delusional? Is he just incompetent? Is his wife running the show? What's the series? And then you kind of get the fact that he's really, really troubled. But I love the whole thing about him chopping wood, which was my favorite part of it. That was great. There was such a great backstory about what about why he's so good at chopping wood and what that maybe did to his personality, which I think was good. And then lastly, five picks of episodes. If you haven't watched Smilf yet, which I think people should do, it's on Showtime. It's on my list of 46 shows from 2017 that they should get to. I would say hang in there because the first two are interesting. They're a little familiar. It doesn't seem like groundbreaking as some of the other 30-minute sort of a tour-driven series. But the third episode, I think, makes the entire series. It's like, here's the potential that I think I saw earlier, but this is way better than I thought it was going to be, and what Frankie Shaw can do. And it's about her character who's just hopelessly needs money because she's got she's got a kid. She's not having any support. She can't work all day. It's really it's a down and out series for starters. And it's a really interesting concept where somebody, one of her friends, kind of hilariously makes money doing this sort of a kink festival online where she just eats food, basically. So it's totally weird. And they get some laughs out of that. About maybe something that Bridget, the character played by Frankie Shaw, could do to make money. And she just said, you got to get on there. There's a lot of people who will pay money for you to do crazy things. And so she finds somebody who wants to pay her $1,000 to go to dinner with her. So she declines because she thinks it's creepy. She ends up accepting $300. He just wants to see her face. They can meet in a public place. You already have this feeling like something really bad is going to happen. And it's also tragically sad, I think. And then they do meet, and both of them are sad, and they meet in the rain in a parking lot. you know, in New England. And then he offers her another $300 to just go inside the store and have a Coke and talk for a few minutes. And it's really, it's just sad. And it's, but it's also like, they kind of make a connection, and then they're not like with each other, but like, they're just two sad people. And they talk about why they're there. And then there's a, like a dream scene inside of it where they're dancing in a costumes in the middle of this store. And you kind of realize maybe this guy is not such a creep, and maybe she's not such a sad sack, and that maybe she has hopes in her life. And then something happens because you know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I don't know. It's really interesting. Really loved that episode. I think it really said what Smilf could become.
All right.
So there you go.
People should watch it. I'm gonna watch it. It's on my list. So speaking of Frankie Shaw and Smilf, you also did the 10 favorite performances, and she was one of your five.
Yeah, she's just really good. I think, sorry, I'm coughing up a storm here. I know that's a bad thing for podcasts.
Mm, people pay extra for that.
Yeah, people's like, doesn't he have a button
he
can press?
Is this the cough edition? Is that the... Do the members of the Incomparable get the non-cough edition? Or do they get more coughs? Which is it?
We don't know. We should bring that up. In the Slack members should be talking about that.
Yes, that's a big debate in the Incomparable member Slack about that, sure.
They'd be like, doesn't Tim have a cough button? He's so unprofessional.
No, he doesn't. I'll just edit it out, except what if I didn't? Oh, no.
She's in there. You should watch Smilf. That's a go. I'll go quickly and say that Christopher Eccleston in The A Word, great. I mean, that's a show I'm telling people to watch. You'll find a lot of great performances in there if you watch that. And I really love David Thewlis in Fargo, but a lot of people have already seen Fargo. They know why he's so good in that. I think the two leftover ones that I want to highlight are Michael Dorman in Patriot. Patriot was my sixth on my list of top shows. I don't think that's probably going to pop up on anybody else's, you know, top 10, 20, 30 list. But we talked a little bit about that. I think that's the most underrated series of 2017. And his performance was really, really interesting. And I love the fact that he has a world's most depressing folk singer and spy. So people should watch that. And then I would just close it out by saying, you know, this has a little bit of a closure to this, Jason, because we did talk about like Kit Harington and Gunpowder and like why, you know, it comes out, it's, you know, it's just three episodes but it's late. Why would you watch it? It's pretty good. I would say the reason not to watch something like that is because, again, I have a list of shows, 46 shows. A lot of people have not seen them, but one of them is Gorilla.
Yeah.
It's on Showtime. It's seven episodes, I think, total. It just kind of got lost there. It was made in England. But the performances are outstanding. The writing is tight. I always say that I've told you this before, when Idris Elba is the fourth most interesting character on your show and actor, then you really have something. And, Babo Cisse, who is the star of Gorilla, puts in such an incredible performance in his role. He's very conflicted. It's 1971 London, and there's a lot of there's radicalized politics, and he gets swept up into it because it really matters, because he's, as a British citizen, he's part of it as well, but so are a lot of immigrants to England at the time. It's a great portrait of that era. But his character is outstanding because he gets swept up in it in a way where you can tell as it's happening he kind of wants to be part of it, but he kind of doesn't. He does his doubt. Everybody else is kind of like true believers, and they're in it, and he's intellectualizing the process. And it's just such an outstanding performance and a really great compact miniseries that people should track down.
All right. So we should talk a little bit about Disney and Fox. Now, this is this is the big one. Disney is going to try to buy, and probably will succeed. They've got to get approvals and things. Most of Fox, other than the Fox Broadcast Network, because Disney already owns a broadcast network, the Fox News Channel, the Fox Business Channel, the Fox Sports FS1 and FS2 national channels, because Disney already owns ESPN. And mm-hmm. those are getting, you know, put in a box and shipped back to the Murdochs. But mm-hmm. the rest of it, and that means FX and FXX, it means the Fox movie and TV studios, which means intellectual property of The Simpsons and Family Guy and The X-Files and all of that stuff. It mm-hmm. means the movies, let's see, Avatar and the X-Men movies and all sorts of other things. Just a huge amount of stuff that will now be owned by already a giant entertainment conglomerate in Disney. And then what I think is the most interesting thing about this is they will own 60% of Hulu. They already own most of BAMTech, the advanced video streaming company. And so you end up in this scenario where they're a huge studio and they've got streaming services on the way and now own another streaming service and own all the streaming tech. And that was the big one. I mean, I'm a comic book fanboy, so I'm excited that, yeah, maybe we'll see the Fantastic Four in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But mm-hmm. my big takeaway was, on a business standpoint, this seems to be Disney like going all in on 21st century direct-to-consumer streaming products. That this is them. They've got a huge catalog now. They're going to have Hulu in their back pocket. Plus, they already have BAMTech. They've already announced two streaming services. It feels like this is Disney saying, we are going to, you know, basically, if not destroy Netflix, we are going to bypass stuff like Netflix and Amazon as much as possible and just sell our services straight to the people.
Yeah, it's... I think we live in a world in as 2017 comes to an end where we've had an amazing amount of news constantly coming at us to the point where we just can't handle it anymore. And so something like this comes along where if we would have had it in a maybe less, I mean, all years are busy, but this one seems really particularly busy. We would have been able to handle this information and been more stunned by it. I think that from a media perspective, this is the biggest merger.
It's huge.
It's unbelievable. And we already have, you know, telecom merging stuff that's going on as well. But this is gigantic. And you're totally right. I mean, it changes the playing field in really weird ways. It basically has Rupert Murdoch selling off much of his stuff. They're going to basically re-entrench as a much smaller but more nimble corporation and what they're going to do. I don't know what that means. I think THR has done a number of pretty good stories about that, including one where, you know, that posits he's just not that happy with his offspring and he's just decided to take the money.
Yeah,
take the money and let
yeah. Bob Iger run it because he might actually have more faith in Bob Iger to take the entertainment business, the CEO of Disney. I will, speaking of THR's coverage, Natalie Jarvie from THR was one of my guests on the Download podcast this week, and we spent mm-hmm. the entire yeah, hour basically talking about this Disney mm-hmm. Fox business, along with Julia Alexander from Polygon. So I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to listen to even more about it. Natalie, super smart, just super sharp, and she had some great perspectives on that. It was really great to talk to her again. Yeah, I just keep coming back to the streaming, though. I mean, there are other stories here, right? Like the Fox Broadcast Network now has no studio when everybody else is vertically integrated so that they can basically produce their own content for their own network, and they make money at all points of the process. And now the Fox Broadcast Channel is not, and they're going to end up being, presumably, they're just going to end up paying Disney to make shows for their network, at least for a while, the show, because most of the shows that are on the network are going to be owned by the old Fox, even though mm-hmm. the new Fox Broadcast Network will be running them. So that's weird. John Landgraf is going to be working for Disney. Mm-hmm. FX and FXX, You're the Worst, and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Disney properties now.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine one of the things I talked to Natalie and Julia about is like branding. Like, I mean, FX and FXX seem to actually have had some success in sort of defining what they are. And I imagine that will continue because Disney's not going to want to, you know, Disney-fy everything. The value of Fox's stuff is in the breadth of their content, and they have a lot more adult stuff, and Disney wants to appeal to adults too, and the Fox and FX brand seem like perfectly fine ways to do that. So I imagine to a certain degree it'll be, if not business as usual, that like John Landgraf and FX is probably going to be allowed to continue doing what they're doing. Although, you know, whether any of that stuff goes to Netflix versus like Hulu or some other service yet to be devised, I don't know.
Yeah, I really wonder about that too. I really do. The things that I took away when the deal was announced were, how does FX play in this universe? Because to me, FX is really kind of a crown jewel in all of the cable and streaming offerings. If you're looking for premium content,
right.
And I just don't know how it ends up in a Disney world. So that I don't have an answer for that. I would love to see where that goes. I also think, and I don't know if you guys touched on this, it's really interesting that within the cable world that both FX and AMC were able to use their, guile and convince their cable people that like, hey, it actually is a good idea if we are allowed to do our own streaming app that is not commercial oriented. And I don't know what happens to those now, because obviously Disney is going to have its own streaming service, and it also owns Hulu. And of course, that brings us back to, I think, what you and I agree is the most interesting and complicated or weird part of the deal, which is why would Disney's want, and they become, since they took over the stake, they're 60%, they basically are the prime shareholder and driver of Hulu, but they're about to launch two of their own services, the sports oriented one, and then in 2019 the Disney one, which I think is going to be, again, it's just going to be gigantic. It is going after Netflix. But what do you do with Hulu if you don't sell it? Like my feeling is they're going to sell it to somebody, but and then that would sort of change the makeup of Hulu. But you have Hulu right now, where they've just done Handmaid's Tale and these other ones. They're getting some footing in the world that's defined by Netflix and Amazon for streamers, and of course will be also defined by Apple as they go forward. So I'm really curious, maybe your thoughts too, about where you think Hulu is going, because it seems to me either Disney just uses it as something where they're able to differentiate their own 2019, you know, Disney streaming product as maybe, you know, I don't know, more. I mean, what they could do is that all the movies could be there and all the TV shows could be on Hulu. There's a lot of things that they could do, but short of selling it, I wonder how relevant it is to their interests.
Yeah, I mean, what we've talked about, it is the big question of this, is what happens to Hulu. I mean, it already exists. It's already got a user base. It's in the U.S., and I'm sure Disney mm-hmm. wants to you know, make everything that they do from now on that they own international, and that's the beauty of being direct to customers and having your own content. Netflix has found this out, is that you can order shows and they go everywhere, whereas if you have to make a deal with somebody, you're buying rights by country, and that stinks, and it makes it hard to launch an international video service. I don't know. I mean, the conversation, the way it went with Natalie and Julia, I mean, we were talking about them keeping it, with the idea being that Disney is going to need a place to put the catalog of material that Fox and Disney generate that is not for kids or Marvel and Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And why not Hulu was basically the argument there, is you could start something yourself, or you could just take the catalog. Like one of the things that I think Julia suggested is just take The Simpsons and put it on Hulu and just say, would you like to watch The Simpsons? You got to watch it on Hulu. It's mm-hmm. all on Hulu. And you know, all the other Fox catalog shows go on Hulu, and along with Disney stuff. And it's a place where that stuff goes. There is a question, like, do they do originals there, or is it sort of a place where the whole catalog resides? Because Hulu has had some success with originals. But, you know, I imagine when I look at this and I think of the two already announced streaming services, I don't think that's the end, right? Like, okay, they've got ESPN mm-hmm. for sports, and they're going to do one that's kind of like family and includes some Marvel and some Star Wars. It's like, that's not all the audiences, right? Like, the adult entertainment audience, not, you know, adult entertainment, wow, bomb, chicka, wow, wow, that kind of thing. Not one of those. The adult entertainment world is not, you know, it where does that go? Mm-hmm. And now they bought even more of that stuff. So maybe the answer is Hulu. Maybe the answer is they have to launch another streaming service. But if you've got Hulu and you own most of it, and Comcast will either go along for the ride, or they'll they'll sell it out and get an exit. So you could put all that in Hulu. Hulu also already sells other packages inside it, right? Not only do they have the over-the-top TV stuff, but they got Showtime in there. So who's to stop them from saying Hulu's also going to be a vehicle in which you can add, it's a new bundle, basically, add in Star Wars Marvel, add in ESPN, add in any other kind of packages they want to load in. So I don't know. I mean, it feels like if they wanted Hulu to be the vehicle, they could do it. And if they want to walk away and make a new thing, they could do that too, but they're just going to have to start from scratch instead of maybe starting with this thing that they already own most of, which is Hulu.
Well, I definitely think they're still going to go forward with their own Disney streaming service.
Oh, sure. I mean, the two they've announced, it's just like, that doesn't seem like it's the end of the story. They either need to announce more, or they need to just sort of take the Hulu piece that they own and pour things into Hulu instead. But it's not a question of like, would they not do those two? My question is like, will they do four? Will they do five? Or will they have it be like Hulu plus these little, you know, other things that you can get? And they're building, it's like a cable bundle, right? They're building a bundle of streamers that you can kind of package together based on your interests, and except it's all from Disney instead of from your local cable company. You get the Disney bundle and you get all the stuff that's in it. I don't know.
Yeah, to own the 20th Century Fox studio and all the films that they've done.
Yeah.
And to own, you know, Star Wars, Pixar, Marvel. I think that is unbelievable going forward from the movie perspective about why you need to buy this. I mean, like, it's a given. Everybody's going to have to get this Disney streaming service. Right. Just so, like, you have to have Netflix. That's a given.
Right. So, I think, and I know there are a lot of people, I've heard from people who are like, oh no, I'm not interested, I'm just going to stay with Netflix. And it's like, well, two things are happening now. One is Netflix is spending a lot of money on originals because their catalog is going to go away. Like, it's going to go away. All of it is going to go away. It's going to be Netflix in 5 years is going to be like HBO, where they've got some licensed stuff, mostly movies maybe, that comes on and then goes off again after 6 months. But almost everything on Netflix of any relevance is going to be originals that they own. Mm-hmm. Because they know that all of the suppliers of content that are not them are going to want to do their own thing.
eventually.
Mm-hmm. Right? And so, it makes sense that that's where Netflix is going, and they've known it for a while. Full credit. They saw this day coming and have been investing in original content for that reason. But once Netflix is just original content and it's just like a kind of a mega HBO, then you look over to the left and you see this package that includes the entire library of Disney and Fox old stuff that they have the rights to, and a whole bunch of originals, original Marvel, original Star Wars TV show, all the Disney and Pixar movies, who knows what else. The contents, everything that's on FX and FXX now would be on there. Then... Imagine Disney giving John Landgraf a budget to program a adult-oriented streaming service, right? I mean, that, imagine FX and FXX as the cornerstone of an adult-focused streaming service, whether it's Hulu or it's some other brand that they invent. Like, that's going to be compelling, and it's not going to be easy to be like, I'll just stay with Netflix. It's going to be hard. It's going to be like back in the day of like, well, do I want HBO? Do I want Showtime? Do I want Cinemax? What do I want? It's like, it's going to be like that. It's not going to be a no-brainer, because they're all going to have great stuff that's exclusive.
Yeah, and I think if there's a moment that sort of, I mean, a lot of early adopters and people who listen to this and, you know, people who are tech savvy are already making the move towards, you know, and are willing to bundle up and buy different bundles. But like, when this happens, the future is streaming, and cable has to be sort of quaking in a little bit, because you're going to be creating these other bundles, that you can get these streaming services. And if you're not already owned by a gigantic corporation at some point, it's going to be really hard to survive.
Yeah, you mentioned AMC and all the stuff that they're doing, and I had this moment of like, well, who owns AMC? And I realized it's not super small, but it's a relatively small ownership group. It is not a giant conglomerate. And I had that moment where I thought, well, How long can they last on their own? You know, somebody is going to walk up to AMC Networks, and that's AMC, IFC, BBC America, Sundance. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, and streaming services, because they have Sundance now and Shudder. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, write a check basically and say, we want your stuff, and walk away with it. Like, it feels almost inevitable, right? Because this is the, and I'm not saying it's good. I mean, in fact, I would argue it's not good in the sense that, you know, it's, there's less choice, and everybody, these giant conglomerates play it safe, and there's lots of things that are bad about it, but it does seem kind of inevitable that everybody, all the entertainment conglomerates are you know, buying guns and ammo for the coming apocalypse of traditional linear TV, because they know that streaming is going to scramble everything, and they want as much ammo as possible for that, for that moment. So I don't know what happens to something like AMC.
That, and there's so many of them, right? There's so many, and you look down the line, you think, oh, those are going to get bought, or that's a streaming service that either will not exist anymore, or will get gobbled up by its competitor, and
right. And that, I, you know, if Disney did turn Hulu into something that was sort of like a base model, like basic cable, and then you add in the other packages, then I could totally see them just snapping up various streaming services and just kind of popping them in and saying, yeah, we own Acorn now, here it is, it's in Hulu. It could,
right and also you know this too, I mean, you think down the line, like, all of these have even greater ramifications for the future because of the overturning net neutrality. I mean, that's
sure. I mean, that's absolutely true.
Turn the spigot down on the little guys and turn them up on the big ones. So
right. I mean, if you imagine a scenario, well, first off, Comcast is going to make sure that all of the NBC Universal Comcast stuff is streaming at full speed on the Comcast network, which you and I believe are both on, because the Bay Area is owned by Comcast. And then, you know, Disney is presumably going to pay to get its streams to work well. Netflix pays to get its streams to work well. And then, yeah, if you are on the outside and you're AMC or somebody like that, like, you're going to look at what they want you to pay, and are they going to pay and pass it on to consumers, or are they going to lay back, in which case their streams are going to be kind of crappy. And that's a part of the story too. So there's a lot. I mean, I tend to be an optimist. I think that a lot of this stuff works out, and there's a lot of panic. This is one of the reasons that I don't like being on Twitter as much as I used to, is there a lot of people who just take everything to the extreme. Every single thing that happens is going to be the worst possible
thing ever.
And it's going to be a disaster. And, you know, that's not true. That's actually not true. There are bad things that will happen, but most things don't end up as the worst possible thing ever. Most things end up in a muddy middle, and that'll happen here. But the issue is that everybody in the entertainment industry is planning for the apocalypse, because they know that a transition period is going to happen, and they want as much preparation and as many components and as much ammo as possible for those moments. I don't think it will actually, you know, end up with, you know, two entertainment conglomerates own anything. I think that there's going to be a mixture of stuff. I don't think it's going to be terrible for consumers necessarily, but it's going to be really different. And nobody knows exactly how.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Bob Iger's got his theories. Les Moonves has his theories. you know, everybody's got ideas, but you know, so does everybody at Comcast, and they've got the pipe and they've got the entertainment. So, and that's why Verizon is buying things, right? And AT&T is what going to be in. I mean, they're all. It's all like these big players, and they're all just sucking everything up because they want to be. They don't want to be left standing when the music stops, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Interesting times ahead.
It's going to be really interesting. I mean, it's probably going to be most of next year before this all gets approved.
Yeah.
So it'll be a while before we see a lot of the direct results yet. But boy, it just could not be like Disney. Disney's not a shrinking violet here. Like, Disney is going for it. Like, they are trying to take control of this. And the BAMTech thing, I tell you, is such an easily missed part of this stream, which is that moment when they just spent several $1 billion to get good streaming tech. Like, we want to own the best streaming tech, and they just bought it. And that's sitting there along with Hulu now. It's amazing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe it'll be good. It'll be the next time you have a television critics something where people can ask questions of TV executives. That's going to be an interesting one, because I do wonder about somebody like John Landgraf, And I also wonder about the Fox Broadcast Network and what the heck they're going to do. And if they're going to just become a we'll buy programs from wherever, or if they're going to lean into like buying a bunch of reality shows and putting on news specials and sports and just like not even and kind of back off on scripted since they don't even have a studio.
A studio. Mm. It's going to be really weird because they're going to have to pay to get it. So
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it shakes up so much in my industry. It's just wow. It's and as I mentioned briefly last time, it's like Dana Walden, who is the head of Fox Network, and really only took it because she was the head of the studio for ages. Her and Gary, and for them to take over Fox, which was kind of, you know, in need of revival. Their deal was, yeah, we'll do it, but we don't want to let go of the studio. And then they were smart, right? Because the studio, that's what they successfully ran that for years, and they didn't want to give it away. And in the Fox world, they're like, okay, we'll do this. We'll take it over. We'll become, you know, the chief programmers of this and take over this network as network presidents. And now, now what's going to happen to her? Because she's going to have to, like,
well, she's going to have to make a decision, or the decision will be made for her because she's the head of the Fox Television Group, right? And so what does that mean? Like, you know, I imagine somebody is going to have to say, you're either coming with us or going with them, or she's going to have to say, I am going with them. And who does she go with? Does she go to Disney with the studio?
Well, that would be where I would go. But whether the decision can be made, I don't know. Maybe she might not have a decision anymore. Maybe be like, you know what? We also, because we merged, we also have these other five people who can run a studio.
Yeah.
That's the scary part in all these mergers, is that these people who have these really powerful jobs are now a duplicate.
And there were thousands. I mean, I read a story that said that there will be, you know, more than 1,000 jobs lost as a net of this, because there will be redundancy. And that does happen. I get it. But it's, you know, it's a... it's still an ugly part of it, is they'll be like, oh, we don't actually need two executives in charge of this, so we'll only have one. And that happens. Yep. I mean, that happened when Disney bought Lucasfilm. It's the same thing. It's like, well, it's great that you've got a whole group in charge of merchandising. We're Disney. It's like, okay. right. So I don't know. It's interesting times for sure. Like, but I was going to say, like, we didn't need more interesting stuff, but this is all part of the same thing. The transition to digital for television and to streaming and away from linear is the story of our time. Mm-hmm. And this is really about that more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just more of the fallout of linear TV going
away. But we can tell everybody just to put a pause on their panic button till 2019, then we're good.
We got some time. 2018, we'll get some ideas, but it's going to be a while before you see it. And then Apple will pop in sometime next year, probably. And who knows how that'll shake out.
I don't know if you saw. I'm not on. I keep saying it. Not on Twitter that much. I'm only there to push my stories, and when I'm there, I look around and I retweet a few things. I did laugh when you know, because now Apple's taking a lot, they're poaching a lot of people, and they're taking people from Amazon, and so that's a big story. Amazon really has to get its act together. They are hiring people, but they really, a lot of people are fleeing and they're going to Apple. Once we did a story where Apple's gonna jump in head first into children's programming, my boss had said, well, there goes the toe in the water strategy. And I retweeted that, and on top of it, I put, yeah, that was never really a believable strategy. And I linked to the story that I did based on you and I doing a podcast ages ago. It was summer, so June. This was like Apple had just announced they were going to pick these two executives up. And I remember I wrote that, you and I had the podcast. I wrote this critic's notebook, and I remember people saying, yeah, really? You think that's a big deal? Like, I'm like, oh my god, this is gonna be a big deal. And like, now they're gonna kind of like take their time getting into it. And that was even a month or two ago. Some people were believing that Apple was gonna, like, well, they may only spend one of their billion this year. I think that was never the idea. And obviously Apple looks at Disney doing all this stuff, and they're like, you know, if we're gonna compete in this, we better get busy.
Yeah. So before we go for the year, I wanted to, since it's just before Christmas, talk about your Christmas playlist.
Yay!
The Merry Christmas Baby, we'll put links in the show notes. It's on Spotify. It's 424 songs on Spotify. I made a version of it on Apple Music that I'll also put in the show notes. It's a little bit shorter because not all of the songs matched, but it's still about 400 songs. It's about 23 to 24 hours of music. You can just press shuffle and fill your house, as I have for the last day or two, fill your house with Christmas music as selected by Tim. So how'd you go about picking this thing?
Well, it's funny because I did it, what, 2025? I built it in 2015, I think. And there's 425 songs on Merry Christmas Baby, which is the big one that you did.
Yep.
And I've still been adding to it. And then last year, I kind of spun it off without saying anything or saying much about it. Because I was listening to that enormous list, and I would stream it in the car. And you'd hit these really, like... It's great. You're sitting around the tree and you've got a little mulled wine or cider or whatever you're having, whatever your beverage of choice is. You're with somebody. The lights on the tree. It's a kind of a mellow song. Not so great for driving. So I created, and of course, driving my kids crazy when I would bring them to school, I would always put the upbeat songs on. And so I created a second playlist called "Our Silent Nights Are Getting Loud," which is a lyric from one of the songs on there.
Yep, and I'll have that link in there for Spotify and Apple Music too.
Excellent. And that's at 161 songs, which I think at the time when I first started it was, I think it was at 40 songs. So it's, I didn't do much to it until this year. And it's at 161 and growing. It's been fun. It's been a lot of fun. I really love it. I'm able to play around and say, I really like this Christmas song, or it's a totally different, like a German Christmas song that's like German techno with, I don't remember who did it. There's a German techno song it's called Achtung Christmas and Achtung Xmas, I should say. And they, drop in snippets of this really authoritative American voice talking about what Christmas means. And it's kind of like it's kind of really weird German like music. And so I put that in there, but now I can, like, if it's a little too slow, I can just put it on Merry Christmas Baby. If it's something I think I would love to listen to in the car, I can put it in Our Silent Nights Are Getting Loud. So
nice.
It's been fun.
So, and there's good, I enjoy the variety of the artists too. A lot of these things are, there are ones in there that I'm like, where did this come from? And then the ones were like, oh yeah, I have that on my Christmas playlist too, which is great. So like Fountains of Wayne is in there, which I really like. They Might Be Giants is in there with Santa's Beard, which is a good one. We got Father Christmas. That's one I really like.
Oh yeah.
Got it in there.
And you know what I've been liking doing this, Jason, is over the last couple of years is that I like to compare versions of songs, and some of them are really interesting. And, the ones that have come up this season or this year or this season, if we want, that have been interesting, are people who have redone, Last Christmas from Wham, and I found an acoustic version, a live acoustic version from Manic Street Preachers, which is a band you would not really think they would cover it, and it is so good and so fun. And then there's a really kind of a fey little slow song, little twee little thing about Last Christmas.
I've heard
version
that one.
It's really, and then I keep coming across ones, and this is what I found out. Oh, by the way, just along that line, Fairytale of New York from the Pogues,
right,
and Christy McCall is one of my favorite Christmas songs ever. And I'm a huge, huge fan of Rostam. And Rostam covered Fairytale of New York. And the first time I heard it, I was like, I don't think this is a good mix, because I don't think Rostam's voice can kind of handle this. But he did find a co-singer, a female singer, who sounds really, you know, in the same ballpark as Christy McCall, who's a fantastic singer. But the more I hear it, the more I like it. The original, I'm always going to have that as my favorite. But what I did find out about Spotify, and I'm a Spotify and Apple Music person, but it's easier for me to, I think, create playlists in Spotify. I did find this out. It's the Spotify search engine. It's just a disaster when it comes to actually finding artists who have made Christmas songs. So, you know, there's a band that I love called Allo Darling, and I also like Camera Obscura. Now, I know everything that those guys have done, And until last year, I didn't know Camera Obscura actually had kind of a Christmas song called The Blizzard. And I didn't know Allo Darling had a Christmas song called Space Christmas. And I was like, how did I miss that? And because I've searched everything all over, I tracked it all over. And this year I found that not only did Allo Darling has they have a New Year's song, but they also have a really interesting Christmas song before they were called Allo Darling. It's the same singer. So that's on there too. So to be able to find these, you can't search the artists. Right. And actually, sometimes you can't even search the songs. You just have to kind of find them other ways on, I don't know how to explain it, find them other ways on Spotify. So that's been kind of a real learning curve for me, but also fun too.
Yeah, I a lot of times I just go throughout the year and I will stumble into something and I'll throw it on a playlist as like, oh, I think that's a good Christmas song, or I'll be searching through some artist's list and then I'll find a Christmas music that they've done, and I'll like kind of like either I'll sample it then or I'll throw it on the pile. And it's just like, because it turns up sometimes at the weirdest times, and not because you're looking for it, but because you're looking at something else, and then it turns out there's a Christmas song about something. And it's fun to see your list. I've got a little holiday playlist of my own, but it's really short. It's only about 40 songs, but it's where I'm slowly kind of gathering. And now with your playlist, it's like, oh my God, there's so much good stuff in there. We have some songs in common. I have Fairy Tale in New York and Santa's Beard. I mean, those are pretty obvious though. And The Fountains of Wayne, you know, One Alien for Christmas, The Man in the Santa Suit. Those are good. You got some Jonathan Colton and John Roderick on there. That's a great Christmas album, the One Christmas at a Time album. I really like the song 2600 on there because I was one of those kids who demanded an Atari 2600 for Christmas when I was young.
That is tremendous.
And I really like Imogen Heap's song Just for Now, which is a fantastic song about being super stressed out at the holidays with your family. And there are many covers.
I don't know if I have that one.
And here's the sign of a potential holiday classic, Tim. There are at least two covers of it now. So Pentatonix did a cover that's actually pretty good. And once you've been Kelly Clarksoned, you know you've made it. And there is a Kelly Clarkson
also
cover.
Also, Pentatonix and Kelly Clarkson are kind of in that same Christmas mode, churning out. They're like the
Walmart. You
gotta
have all once you're doing a Christmas album all the time, like endlessly, you're gonna chew through the songs. But check out Just for Now, Imogen Heap. It's really good, and it includes the line that you will appreciate, which is "Pour me another. Oh, don't wag your finger at me."
So that is that is tremendous.
My other recommendation, Carol of the Meows by Guster, which is literally it's Carol of the Bells, except they just sing meow over and over again. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Guster has done some pretty interesting Christmas stuff that I discovered this year.
You got Donde Esta Santa Claus on your list, which is a pretty funny one. Yeah, that's a good one.
I think with people who hopefully these are certainly our joint Christmas lists. If people find them and they'll get into them. The fun thing about it, if you actually like Christmas music, and then a lot of this is a lot of these are originals, and the originals are really great. I think.
Yeah, I noticed that in your list is like a bunch of songs where I'm like, this just sounds like a song I would like. What is going on here? And the answer is that's exactly it. It's a song that you would like. And
there's Christmas reference, right?
Happens to be about Christmas or winter or something like that. And that's good too. Like to get some good music in there too.
And I'll give you a perfect example of this. So I love this band Allo Darling, which I just mentioned, and they just ceased existing this year, but they're lovely. I should put that out for anybody who, loves they're just an interesting all their albums are really good. So it turns out they have a song called Silver Swans in NYC, which is technically not a Christmas song other than there's swans in it, but also it's about a song where your parents are calling you, you're an expat from Sweden, etc., and their parents are calling you saying that they've booked a flight for you to come back home for Christmas, but you kind of don't want to go, and what it means if you do go to the person that you're seeing, etc. It's actually a really lovely song, and I didn't know it existed, and I found out that it actually was written when, I guess there were several name changes for Allo Darling before they settled on that, but it's under it's under all ALL, comma, darlin. So they were, that's how they were billed on this album called 12 Days of Christmas. And I would say that me discovering Silver Swans in NYC was, for me personally, like, where did this even come from? And that, I think that's an example of, so it's 2009 on an indie label called Bubble Wrap Records. And to be able to deep dive and find this thing is the joy that I get, but also like finding obscure bands who do a really good Christmas song that's not, as we just said, like it's not, you know Jingle Bells or something like that, or you know what I mean, it's not a classic in the canon. They just created their, it's not Drummer Boy, they've come up with their own. And there's a joy in that, and there's also a joy in finding who does really interesting versions of the classics.
Yeah, it's and having them all mashed together is a really fun combination, because then you're like, you know, you go from something that you might hear on a regular playlist or on the radio or something, and then there's a classic, and then there's a classic but not as you know it, which is a lot of fun too. So I'm enjoying it. People should check them out. Get in the spirit. And I like, this is that other side of you, right? This is the former music critic and guy who loves music side of you that we don't always get to experience here.
Yes, exactly.
That's good. It's all good. And before we go, I have a small number of tweets I want to share with you.
Okay, let's do.
It's a limited number. Our friend My Vogon Poetry wrote in, the MVP, with a great observation, which is, I noticed the first three shows on Tim's top TV list start with the word "the." Does that automatically up a show's prestige level? And would it help Fuller House if it were called The Fuller House? And would it hurt Wire?
Yes, if it was not The Wire. Clearly, it would not be one of the greatest. Yes, clearly it would not. And you know what? MVP gets I found that. I was like, okay, that's this. It was MVP smoking a gigantic bowl when she came up with this. But I have to give her credit, because she made a gif.
It's a he.
Of,
I think MVP is a he, but it doesn't
really
matter. Yeah, I think
okay.
So.
All right. He or she made a gif of...
It was like a scrolling list of your whole list.
It's
nice. A boy.
It's very nice.
It's a man. It's a fellow. Right. But it's the MVP. That's all, all that matters. Anyway,
yes.
that was very nice. Listener Merlin in the 415, this is my pal Merlin Mann, wrote in to say, Tim, thanks for cluing me to Patriot. It's astonishing that I totally lost that one in the lights. Times of confusion. That's right. You lose it in the lights sometimes. You're like, whoa, what's what? Shows are raining down on me. And you miss some of them.
Yeah.
And I think a telling note for how our conception of television and television seasons is changing. This is our friend Dean, traveler of the 707. Saying, after watching the 8-episode first season of Stranger Things, 6 episodes of The Tick, and 8 episodes of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, I look at The Punisher's 13 episodes and I think, man, that sounds like a lot. It's just, we're going to turn into the UK sooner rather than later. It's all going to be like 5-episode seasons.
Yeah, I think that that's sooner the better for me, because like I said when I was talking about Jane the Virgin, oh my god, I look at that 22 episodes and I'm thinking, I can't get that rock up the hill.
That's a lot.
I just can't.
A lot of episodes.
I can't do it.
It's a lot. All right, well that is, I think, going to wrap it up for TVTM 2017.
2017, yes.
Put it down.
158 episodes.
Yeah, we didn't do those all this year, though. Thank goodness. Good.
Oh,
proof.
That's
can
true.
You even imagine?
And that was never good.
No,
enough.
We did about 50, we did about 50. You know, I think we're good for about 50 a year. That's not bad.
That's pretty good. That's astonishing. You know what? If you had said that to us in the old world, I would have said no. That's never happening.
Not even when you were recording 2 at a time. Remember that? Those were the golden era. The golden era of TVTM when there were 2 episodes a week because there was just so much to do. And then like 8 months would pass. But then, you know, that would be...
And then that second episode where there'd be no air in the room and they were the weirdest episodes ever.
That was when the magic happened. You will be happy to know that that Mick LaSalle is once again going to have a podcast on the Chronicle. So
really?
Yep.
You know what? I heard this podcasting thing has taken off.
It is.
Baby.
It's happening. The Chronicle has decided podcasting is the wave of the future. And bless them.
Oh, I love it. 10 years later.
Yep, that's right. Well, you know, blazing trails. That's the deal with yeah. you and Benny and Joe. Blazing trails for the Chronicle to follow a decade later. And they're still there. That's the thing. You're the one who got out, but they're still there. Unfortunately, the Chronicle is still there. I will say that as a resident of the Bay Area, I am glad the Chronicle continues to be published. I was wondering
doing strong
for a while
work over there,
but they're mm-hmm. doing, but they're doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks to everybody out there for listening this year to the TV Talk Machine, and we will be back in January. But we do appreciate that all of you listening and sending in your questions and sending in your tweets. It's great. So
yes, thanks to everybody.
And Tim, it's always a pleasure to talk to you about TV stuff. Have a good Christmas and a happy new year.
All right, same to you. We'll see you in 2018.
Did I need to Columbo you for the year there? No, is that... Goodbye, everybody.